Arnsworth Reel 3.
Now, amongst the equipment you use, some of it you told me was pretty archaic. Some of it was Boer War equipment, like the 4.7 guns. What about the signallers of equipment? Was that of any great vintage as well?
Well, I don't know what sort of signal equipment they had in the Boer War. The telephone that we had was reasonably efficient. It worked on two 1.5-volt batteries, dry batteries. That was 3 volts, you see. And mostly we used it for Morse, but not close up the line. When we were in France, we used a fuller phone. Then that
a
didn't
what?
A fuller phone, they called it.
Fuller.
Yes, that didn't give out a buzz like the other one did. It sent a steady current along the line, which became a buzz at the other end. But you see, with Jerry's listening equipment up in the front line, it could pick up the vibrating signal, but it couldn't pick up the steady signal.
Was there an actual difference in the notes between the various kinds of equipment?
You can adjust the note yourself according to your with a screw, you see. The higher the frequency of the armature blade, the higher the note, of course, it went. And you could adjust the travel of the key as well. I liked a short travel and a high note as well.
Well, what sort of range finding equipment did you use when you were training?
They only had that one at Sunk Island, the Barron Strout, but we only went there for tests, that's all. But we never used it, of course, it was a permanent coastal defence thing. We didn't have any range-finding equipment in training at all.
How did the Barron Stroud work, the Barron Stroud range-finder?
Well, it's the same idea as your own eyes. Your line of sight from each eye meets on the object, and that alters the angle. And from that, you can determine the range. Well, on the Barron Stroud, the left-hand one was a fixed angle of 90 degrees. The right-hand one, you could alter it by means of what they called a Prandtl prism in the right-hand tube. You altered that, and at the same time as you were moving that, you were altering the range on the drum. And when you'd made coincidence, that was your objective on the left eyepiece, you saw both objects, one superimposed above the other. And the idea was to get them dead in line, say a ship's mast. You'd have the one ship mounted on top of the other, the mast to mast. You'd then light up with a little button the other eyepiece, which would show you the range jumps, like a speedometer, worked exactly the same principle. You know, the Marlings recording party, the drums were revolved like that, and that would read out the range. That had a range of 40,000 yards. That one on the coastal defence.
Before you went to France, you changed over from 4.7 inch
60-pounder.
To 60 pounders.
Yes. We got those in the early part of 1916, you see, and as soon as we got those, things started moving fast.
Yeah. When you got the 60 pounders, were there any sort of operational differences in handling them as compared with the 4.7s?
No, not really. They were more up to date gun in this much that it was designed as an actual field gun, not as a naval gun. And it had a very long traverse, a very long recoil, you see, which made the gun very steady. You didn't have to keep relaying it every time you fired a shot like that with a 4.7. Honestly, bloody hopeless on the ground, you know.
But for the members of the gun crew, were there any differences at all in handling the 60 pounders as against the 4.7?
Not at the actual service, except that they didn't have to keep pulling it back into position. But we could get, for a time, with a 60-pounder, if we got the order gunfire, that means as fast as you can get them off, we could do 3 rounds a minute. And that consists of, first of all, you put the shell into the breech, and then you have a long ramming tool, a drift, they call it. You stand with your back to the gun after you put that in, and ram it home, because the driving band must bite on the lands. Otherwise, if it was short and then banged up against them by the cartridge, it would tear the driving band loose and the shell wouldn't go its proper range. When you'd put that in, you put the cartridge in, which was tied at one end and had a red patch on the other end. Well, that red patch was the ignition end with black powder underneath that red piece. You pushed that in, then you closed the breech, which closed the breech block itself, had threads on it. There was 3 sections of 60 degrees and 3 blanks. And the breech ring to which the block entered had the same. And when you entered it, the threads went into the blanks. Well, then the lever had a link connecting it from the lever itself to the bottom of the breech block. And when you closed the breech lever further, that link caused the breech block to revolve by 60 degrees, thereby locking all the threads together. And at the front end of the leading end of this breech block, there was what they called an obturator pad. That was a sort of a pad with a sealing ring around it. And when it was compressed, finally, that sealing ring prevented any blowback of gases, you see. Mm-hmm. Well, then there was a hole right through the breech block, by which means you ignited the cartridge. You put in a little tube, revolved it 90 degrees, which locked it. And then there was a little loop on that, metal ring on that. You hooked, you landed into that. And when you pulled that, this caused a flash, almost like striking a match. And the flash went through and impinged on the red end of the cartridge, thereby ignited the cartridge, and that blew the shell out at a muzzle velocity of actually 2,088 feet per second on a new gun, the 60-pounder. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you lost 1 foot per second for every 25 rounds fired. Normally, you used to reckon about 4 feet per second for every 100 rounds.
Why did you lose it?
Well, same reasons you lose compression on an engine as it wears. Mm-hmm. The shell and the gun are like a piston and cylinder, aren't they? Mm. And as the gun begins to wear, you see, naturally you get a slight leakage of gas. The life of a 60-pounder was supposed to be 3,000 rounds, but it's at Ypres in 1917 we were firing up to 5,000 rounds because we never had the six guns in action. The rate of firing was such that the gun wanted a new tube in about every 3 weeks.
Really?
Yes. Mm. We never had the... We used to go down to take them down to Saint-Omer, behind, you know, to... there was an ordnance depot there. Mm. We'd take them down there, and we'd bring in... our own gun would be slung under these shear legs. The piece, the barrel, would be taken out, you see, and a new piece, a relined piece, they'd put into our gun, and they'd come with it like that. You didn't wait while your own was done. Mm-hmm. Because this tube was detachable. The rifle tube was detachable in the British gun and could be taken out. And a new one pressed in. The German guns are all solid. They had to scrap the whole thing.
I see. Now, you told me that when you went to France, by the time you actually got out there, mm-hmm. you had to relearn practically everything that you'd been taught.
Yeah.
Could you give me some examples of the kind of things you had to relearn?
Well, sighting of lines, for a start. Mm-hmm. The first consideration was you'd got to sight the line so that it wouldn't be damaged by enemy shell fire, which meant, as far as possible, keeping it on the ground or out of the way of splinters and such as that. And also blast, because if a shell dropped nearby, you could have it cut with splinters. Or if you're in, say, tall grass and the line didn't get onto the ground, the blast would stretch the line to such an extent that it would break the wire inside, sometimes without breaking the insulation, and an experienced singular... signaler, you could tell at once. You used to run your hand along the wire, you'd feel the break inside. Whereas an inexperienced man would, oh, well, there's nothing wrong with that, it's all in one piece, but it wasn't. There's a break.
Yeah. How would you sight the lines so as they'd be at their least vulnerable?
Try and get it in a dike side or anything like that. If you found one of these disused railway lines, little railway lines that was not in use, there's a drainage gutter at either side, they used to dig the earth out and pile it in the centre to lay the line, you see, and then the drainage gutter to the other side. Well, we'd leave the wire in the gutter, you see. All right. Mm.
Any other tricks you used to use?
No, not particularly.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What? Give me some other examples of the things you had to relearn.
When we had to go up the front line with it, we had to go to the OP, of course.
The OP?
Observation post. Mm. You had to peg your wire then into the side of the trench. And we used to make the... staplers out of baling wire from the hay bales, you see, to save that and then bend it with pliers and so that we could put your wire and plug it in the trench. Infantry used to come in overnight and with a pack and equipment, catch it in a loop of your wire and tear it out and cuss and swear about it, bloody signaller's wire. Then you'd got to go and put it back again. The wire which they were pulling about was very often, well, to some extent, instrumental in saving them a lot of trouble. Mm. Because if they wanted artillery support and the wire was broken, well, of course, it was a bit awkward. Mm. They couldn't get it.
Mm. Any other examples of the kind of things you had to relearn when you got out to France?
We couldn't use the lamps in the ordinary way until we got the Lucas E lamp.
Why couldn't you use the lamps in the ordinary way?
Well, because the beam of a lamp was visible from not only from in front, it was visible from the side as well. And I've known the cases when we've been so far forward, you see, observation, that you couldn't have a wire or anything like that, it might be damaged. Well, we'd use these E-lamps, that was like almost like a fog lamp, about that size, you see, about 5 inches diameter. It had a 12-volt battery and a little switch, you see, like that. The lamp itself had a little spike on it. You could stick the lamp anywhere and you could get down out of cover. I think from 6 or 10 feet of cable to it, you see. But you didn't have to work the lamp yourself. You could get in a hole and stick it so that if anybody shot at the lamp, they didn't hit you. Formerly, the lamps we had, you'd got to work the lamp direct, so that if anybody shot at the lamp, you stood a chance of getting it as well. Mm. So they had filters. You could get a green, a red, or a yellow filter for the light. That was sort of a flexible sort of celluloid stuff, discs. You also had a metal filter, which consisted of two discs. One would revolve on the other, and each of those discs had six holes in it, about, I should say, 3/4 of an inch across, maybe 1/2 inch. If you exposed the holes fully, you got a reduced amount of light from the reflector, but you could move your disc so that you only got sort of an ellipse, you see, six ellipses, sufficient to be read, maybe 50 or 100 yards away, but not visible to for any great distance, you see. And the thing is, main thing was, there was no actual beam of light. I mean, you can see your headlamp beams, can't you, overnight, from the side. Well, you still could see these lamps as well, you see. So, but if you've got the lamp filtered like that, they don't see the beam.
I see. This must have been a problem at most times at night to make sure the enemy didn't see any lights. For example, when you were reading instruments, you would need some light to do that.
We only needed that when we were sort of plotting to find an enemy battery, you see. Mm. Normally, ordinary night worker observation party, there was not much doing.
You told me yesterday that there are some occasions when you used to use the light of a cigarette.
Yes.
What was that for?
That was when we wanted to find an enemy battery. We'd have 3 observation posts out so they could get at him from 3 directions. All you had to start with was, say, a flash reflected on low cloud or, say, from behind a wood or something like that. But you wanted to know exactly where he was, so that if there was a stunt coming off, you'd be able to use sufficient shell fire to put that battery out of action. So you had a director, which was an instrument mounted on a tripod, consisted of a scale fixed to the tripod, naught to 180, and the 180 was at the front. So you'd want 180 back to zero on either side. You had a ruler sort of thing, which erect at each end with a slot and a wire. Jerry had the telescopic thing with the cross wire in, but we didn't get as good as that. That had a pointer you could move in any direction. Now, before it got dark, you would clamp your director on some known reference points, and after that you mustn't touch it. You would then loosen your sighting rod for use. When the enemy battery started firing, you would gradually get your sighting rod dead onto him, and then on the pointer at the rear you would read off the angle from your reference point, and you did that by cupping your hands over a cigarette, because obviously if you could be in a position to have a direct line of sight towards the enemy, he could also see you if you had a light. The next thing was,
so you just take a pull on the cigarette,
that's right, to make it glow, and you could read it like that. Then you had to determine the distance away he was from you. And to do that, you timed from the flash to hearing the report. Well, from 3 different observation points, those angles and those times were sent back to brigade. Well, they knew the speed of the wind over the ground at all that area. They plotted back the angles and the distances as worked out by the sound, and that would result in usually a little triangle, which was called the triangle of error. But you could be almost certain that the enemy battery was within inside that triangle.
I see. Good. That's fine. going back to my earlier question about things which surprised you, that you had to relearn, and or jobs you had to do in different ways than you had been trained to do because of the conditions on the Western Front. Were there any other examples you can think of?
Only that we didn't have the horses up the battery, only on about once, I think, that's all, when it was very, very quiet. We had a few horses just to the, you know, out of sight in the wood behind. But they were only used really to give them a bit of exercise. So there was no real need for them.
Now you told me that under operational conditions the lines would be constantly damaged by shell fire, and therefore you'd have to spend a lot of time repairing them. How did you actually go about that?
Well,
tell me about a sort of wire repairing operation.
In the first place, you'd know where the shelling had taken place to some extent, so that you'd have a good idea where it was. Well, you went out equipped with a telephone, to which you had a wire on the terminals, a twin wire, and on the other side end of that wire, you had two safety pins. And you used those to push the pin through the insulation of the wire to make metal contacts. You could then communicate with anybody on that line. So, as long as you could get your battery, say, on that line with the pins, you knew that the line was intact up to there. You'd go beyond that until you reached a point where you only got the other end and not the first end. So you knew then that the break was in between those two.
I see.
So having localised the break, you then proceeded to mend it. You pared the insulation back for about 3 inches either side. You took a double reef on it, not just one turn, a second turn, otherwise the wire would skid and spin. You knotted it like that, then pinched it off with your pliers. Then you had a reel of insulating tape, and you bound it round with that, and probably your uncle, that was supposed to be all right of the repair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it were as a rule. But if the wire, you come to a broken end, of course, well, of course, then you'd got to strike an arc round to find the other line and then come back, and you'd probably find that the line had been, with the blast, had been blown so far that the other end might be, 20 or 30 yards away, and you'd got to find it in the dark. Stubbing it with your toe very often through the grass, if there were no other lines near.